It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about the global impact of air conditioning as the world heats up.
First, police shot and killed a man on Saturday afternoon in Milwaukee. In the hours afterward on Saturday night, an interaction between police and a crowd turned violent.
Fires were set at a gas station and other local businesses. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett held a midnight press conference urging calm and announced an increased police presence in the coming days.
On Sunday night, there was renewed unrest in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood, and Governor Walker activated the National Guard to assist Milwaukee police.
The events of the weekend have renewed questions about police relations and racial disparities in Milwaukee.
John Diedrich has been covering that developing story for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins us now. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, John, can you start by telling us about Saturday afternoon's fatal shooting? What happened?
So this information comes from the police department and from the mayor's office. Some of the information from this shooting, body cam video, autopsy reports, and so forth have yet to be released. But the account that police give is that two police officers were on patrol. They sought to make a traffic stop of a car. There are two individuals in that car. One of them was Seville Smith, who ultimately was fatally shot. They say that he ran out of the car, jumped out of the car. He had a weapon in his hand, a semi-automatic weapon that turned out to be loaded with 23 rounds and also happened to be stolen. And exactly how it was that he was shot is still, details are still coming out, but that he essentially was reaching for the gun, grabbing for the gun. It's unclear whether he was actually pointing the gun, but the police officer shot Smith twice, once in the chest, fatally, and he was also hit in the arm. And this is all in the area near Sherman Park, which has been the area of some problems all summer.
And what do we know so far about the man, Seville Smith, who was shot?
Well, he does not have a felony conviction on his record, though he does have a number of arrests. He was arrested 9 times in the last 4 years. He was charged 3 times, but 2 of those were dismissed. The most serious charge against him, he was convicted of a misdemeanor of carrying a concealed weapon. The most serious charge, though, was he was charged with shooting a man, and then secondarily charged with trying to intimidate that individual from testifying. Ultimately, that man recanted his story, and those charges were dropped. And there's also some drug charges that were ultimately did not lead to, they were drug arrests that did not lead to criminal charges, and there's a robbery charge, a robbery case at which did not proceed into court as well.
And what about the police officer involved? Any facts known about him?
Well, we don't know his name. His name's not being released, which is a little bit unusual. This police department has generally released the name of an officer. In this case, though, they say they're not because of concerns about his safety. Here's what we do know. He's been on the force for 6 years. He's only 24. The reason for the age issue there is that he joined the department when he was 18 through the police aid program. He's African American. That had been one of the sources of information circulating on Facebook, is that this was possibly a white officer. And again, the police chief and the mayor have downplayed that, said it wouldn't matter if it had been a white officer, that this was a justified shooting. But that he's 24 years old, and he's been on the force for 6 years, but been a police officer really only a couple years, because the police aid program goes for about 3 or 4 years.
We're talking with John Diedrich right now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's bringing us up to date on the latest in the police shooting in Milwaukee this weekend and on its aftermath. And John, let's get to what happened after that shooting later on towards the evening. What happened?
Well, later Saturday night, after 8 o'clock or so, in that general area of where the shooting happened, there's also been unrest in there, circulating around a gas station that's right next to Sherman Park and also in Sherman Park. In that gas station, a couple months ago, there was an incident in which a clerk was having trouble, he said, clearing the audience or the crowd's customers from the store. And he came outside with a gun and fired it in the air. He ultimately was charged in that case, but it really symbolized what it sounds like has been strained relations between young people in the area and that business. In addition to that, in that park, there were some problems around the 4th of July. Anyway, Saturday night, crowds were forming near the park. Police came out and we're moving the crowds that were in the street away, and then some violence broke out at that point. There was cars that were smashed and lit on fire, including squad cars. The business itself, the gas station, was started on fire, and then about four blocks away, actually right across the street from District 7 Police Department, three businesses there were damaged, two of them burned, a beauty supply store, a car auto supply store, and then the bank actually right next door to the police station, BMO Bank. Those windows were broken, and then there was two liquor stores that were burned as well in the nearby area.
And what information is known so far about who was involved in some of the things you described on Saturday and on into Sunday night?
Well, there's still, and you're exactly correct, there was more trouble last night. The investigation into the arson, there was looting, at least at a cell phone store. There were also guns fired up into the air, gunshots fired at the police district station, at squad cars and so forth. The investigation continues into that. There were arrests that were made, but as we're being told right now, we're not hearing about anybody charged precisely with inciting that unrest and rioting that happened. Or how close they are in terms of making those kinds of cases. But the police department has said they are closely investigating video from the area and other evidence that would point to who had a hand in this destruction.
And I know one of the big questions you've said you're working on, John, is why did this happen now? Why the strong reaction? And how are you answering that question so far?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the history of Milwaukee, you alluded to this at the beginning about strained racial relations. We're one of the most segregated cities in the country, and there's been a series of high-profile in-custody deaths that have happened in Milwaukee. And some of those have circumstances that, at least from what we know so far, appear to be more aggravated. Individuals who are not armed, for instance, or in the case of Frank Jude, who was, unarmed and was beaten severely by off-duty officers, Derek Williams, who died in the back of a squad car gasping for air. There are other circumstances, but it would appear as though, I think at this point, the best we're hearing is that this was a flashpoint type of case where the circumstances and what came out later were not what was spreading around Facebook. And even had all the facts been known, it might have made a difference. There was such a sort of boiling over effect, especially given what had happened at the park and the gas station earlier in the summer, that it all sort of was a perfect storm, if you will, for problems to really erupt.
And the community of Sherman Park, how has it responded to what's happened so far?
Well, Sunday morning, there was a real outpouring of people, not just from Sherman Park, but from across the city coming in support. I mean, there was your onlookers and sort of gawkers that came through to look at these burned-out businesses. And it's not clear whether anything's going to be rebuilt, which is the unfortunate reality of this kind of destruction. But people came out and forced churches, other groups to support the community, to pick up trash. That was a big thing that was happening all day on Sunday. And that, was displaced later by more of these confrontations between mostly young people, I think, is what is what we're understanding. I don't think a lot of sort of older middle-aged people are in the midst of this, but that there was this sort of, for most of Sunday, this very much of a community outpouring that was happening to help clean up the area, and, you know, and also talk about you know, opportunity that is needed for young people. That's a theme that's underneath this. Black unemployment's very high. Black incarceration's high. There's a lot of, you know, social economic factors that are coming to bear in these neighborhoods that are certainly aggravating the situation.
And just briefly, as far as the investigation into the shooting itself, what's next?
So the Department of Justice is doing this investigation. That's under a law that passed. A colleague of mine wrote an investigation, and that investigation resulted in an outside agency, in this case the Department of Justice, doing in custody death or police shooting investigation. So that is ongoing right now. What the mayor and the police chief have asked for in this case is that the Department of Justice quickly release the body cam video and also the autopsy report to indicate that the individual, Mr. Smith, was not shot in the back, as has circulated on social media, or also to show what the officer's actions were. So we may see some of the evidence even before the determination is made as to whether it was a justified shooting. But the Department of Justice, State Department of Justice, will do the investigation. And in the meantime, as always the practice, the officer is on paid leave right now.
John, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was John Diedrich, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joined us with the latest on this weekend's police shooting in Milwaukee and the community response.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our coverage of the latest events in Milwaukee, where an officer shot and killed a man after a foot chase on Saturday afternoon.
Violence broke out on Saturday night after a standoff between police and an angry group of people. Some community members came out, as we just heard, to clean up and urge peace on Sunday, but last night did see renewed unrest. The shooting reignited the urgency behind questions about racial divisions in Milwaukee.
Wisconsin State Senator Lena Taylor spoke at the site of a burned BP station on Sunday, urging those listening to demand change and to vote. Senator Taylor is a Democrat from Milwaukee and represents Wisconsin's 4th District. Senator Taylor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
What was your first thought when you heard about first this shooting and then the events that followed on Saturday night?
Of course, your heart drops each and every time. It's a life, it's a family that has gone through some level of trauma, and every time, candidly, that we hear of an incident in our community, we're all traumatized to some level. And then, of course, to see the community being destroyed in front of your eyes is overwhelming. As a business owner, you think of the challenges for those business owners and for the individuals who worked there. You think of all of the property damage. But the human capital and the, you know, the harm, the injury, you know, the hurt that it inflicts, and then it makes you, you know, at least it makes me, go beyond just the surface of look at what you did. And maybe it's the mother, you know, in me that always takes you beyond just the surface of what you did, but why you did it and how to make it where that's not what we're going to have that's reoccurring. And those are the things that went through my mind when it first happened. And then to go and try to be the example of moving forward in a way to get the change that individuals want to see, to help show and navigate how to do that in a productive way, right? That is not as harmful.
And you were there, as you say, you were urging people listening to you on Sunday. You were at that BP station that was burned. You asked...
Actually, I was right next door. I was right next door on the block, the same block, but not at the station itself. But yes, ma'am, very near it.
And on that site, you were speaking to the people who were there, community members, others who had come, and you were urging them to let their voices be heard, to vote. But not everyone there, it sounds like, was on board. According to the Journal Sentinel, it sounds like some people, maybe in the minority, a few voices, though, not sure that they'd get a fair shake or that anything would change. So what would you say to people who are feeling disenchanted about the prospect of change and about the effectiveness of politicians.
Well, that's exactly what I said when I was on CNN, that you have to understand the level of trauma that exists in this community. Individuals not feeling hopeful and feeling hopeless, not feeling as if they're heard, and not feeling that the change that is needed and that they want to see in their community is happening, and not having civics to even know exactly, like, who do we navigate through to get X, Y, or Z done, depending on what those things are. You know, there are many things that touch these families and the individuals in the community. And so what you do is you come down and you mimic and you show. So what I did was show them how you make your voice heard about what you disagree with, but how you do that in a way that allows you to express your constitutional right to do that, but how you also think about cleaning up your community. So, you know, we came with bags and gloves and garbage bags and encouraged people to go out and be the change, right? Help clean up the community. But we've also got to help clean up the hurt and the damage and the harm that's been done because of all of the trauma that has existed in this community. So it's not just the property damage that we have to address. We have to address the human damage, the human damage, the heart.
And in some ways, that's the harder part to heal, the heart you talk about.
Amen.
The hurt and the damage.
Amen.
And the harm. So how do you start to do that? Because it's not a quick fix. It's a journey.
You know, it is. And you start by doing small activities. I mean, I think Greater New Birth Church coming out and doing work with the for the police officers and showing support of law enforcement, I think that helps with some healing in community police relationships. I think that that's important. I think the people who came out and picked up garbage in the area, that was helpful. I think the people who wrote notes to say comments to the business owners to thank them for their work, that meant something. But we've also got to give an opportunity to the young people who feel hopeless. We have to give them an opportunity, and to the other individuals in the community, because let's be clear, it's not the young people of this behavior that we're talking about. These were some grown people. Now, they might have been younger adults than some of us, but they weren't like little kids or teenagers, you know, that were making these choices. So those individuals are the individuals who need an opportunity to be able to learn. Even one of the things I realized that we need to do is teach them civics so the individuals know, well, how do you rally and how do you protest? Do it in a way to get results. And so with that in mind, you know, it's not going to be easy. This is going to be a journey. You know, we didn't get here overnight. This has been 30 more years of individuals who were teen mothers who did not know, individuals who did not graduate from high school, individuals who did not have the literacy levels that they needed. And so we had adults who were not literate. You know, all of this creates where we are. And now we want people who have been broken, harmed by poverty and the constant issues that have existed in the community. We want them to think as the healthiest people we know. And that's just not what we've learned from trauma-informed care.
We're talking with Wisconsin State Senator Lena Taylor. She's with us to talk about the police shooting in Milwaukee this weekend and about the community reaction. And Senator Taylor, what do you think that the shooting and its aftermath reveals to you about the challenges that Milwaukee still has ahead of it, and maybe about the urgency now of some of these issues facing Milwaukee in terms of opportunity and education and closing the gap on some of these things?
Well, as a girl who lives on the same block that I grew up on, they're not new to me. It's what you could look on any Wisconsin Eye video. Any time that I've spoken to speak about the issues that exist and what the needs are in the community, but I hope what it's done is it's awakened us to what our institutions have created, what the policies and the institutional challenges and disparities have created, and that if we're going to see different, then we need to see what's good, what's bad, our good, our ugly. We need to begin to address it and fix it. It's going to require investment in the areas where individuals need to work past their trauma. It's going to have to require connecting people to industries and opportunities, and I think we can use community connectors to do it. So it's taught me that the work is going to be hard, as we already know it is, but that people, more people are awake, I think, because of what they're seeing. It's kind of the same thing in some ways that happened previously, you know, when people could see what people were going through because it was on a TV screen. You know, I think the truth of the matter is not that you can see that there are individuals that we've helped to develop in a way where they're not as compassionate, where they're willing to do and go to the extremes that they have, that we've got to be willing to say, why is that? And try to get to the root of that. And so it says to me not only sense of urgency, but that I feel like there are new partners all around the nation and including in our state that are ready to roll up their sleeves. And if not, then shame on all of us for not making it that way. And so I'm just going to continue to do the work that I've been doing. And I believe in that article that the JAMA did, Journal of American Medical Association. They said that exercise and gardening reduce. I want to use agriculture as a way to help create hubs for healing in our community. It may sound a little corny or quirky to some people, but it's already proven to be successful and work. And I believe that we have to start one neighborhood, one block, one person at a time. And if everybody says, I want to be found doing something to make a difference, to implement some love and faith, some hope in its communities, and to be a part, get where we want to be. It takes all of us.
Senator Taylor, just a couple seconds left. We saw unrest Saturday night and Sunday night. Is it over?
You know, I will tell you, it's been difficult to talk some young people and older people back into sensibility. But that's also part of what we've been doing on the ground, is talking to individuals and saying there's another way. So I hope that it is, but I woke up this morning, it was not. And so I will continue to be out here doing my part.
Thank you.
To encourage people to think different.
Thank you so much for joining us. That was Senator Lena Taylor. She's a Democratic state senator from Milwaukee, representing Wisconsin's 4th District.
Coming up after the news, a look at the global environmental and energy impact of air conditioning. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we look at the questions raised about Hillary Clinton's use of email when she was Secretary of State and new questions about whether she used her position to benefit donors to the Clinton Foundation.
First, all over the world, temperatures are on the rise and summers are getting hotter. Here in Wisconsin, a recent heat wave brought heat indexes in excess of 100 degrees Fahrenheit, as well as at least one heat-related death. Experts predict that 2016 will be another record-breaking year for average temperatures, and the following years could bring more of the same.
As our next guest points out, that likely means the use of more air conditioning throughout the world. As the climate gets warmer and incomes go up, sales of air conditioners are spiking. While it's good news that more people are going to be able to live in comfort, it also means a significant increase in the use of energy.
Joining us now is Lucas Davis. He's an associate professor of economic analysis and policy at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, where he's also the faculty director of the Energy Institute. He co-authored a recent paper on the global impact of air conditioning. Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Hello.
Well, you say that sales of air conditioners have exploded worldwide over the last few years. Can you just give us a sense of how much this is spreading around the country and around the world?
Yeah, sure. You bet. So it's not as much the rich countries like the U.S. Wisconsin people have air conditioning and have had air conditioning now. It's in middle-income countries. So China is a great example. Chinese sales of air conditioners have doubled in the last 5 years. And now every year in China, there's 60 million air conditioners that are sold. So that's like 9 times as many air conditioners are sold in the U.S. So it's just a dramatic increase in air conditioner sales.
And that doesn't look like that trend is going to stop anytime soon, does it?
No, it doesn't. In fact, in working on this paper, we took a look around the world, and there's a lot of countries that are both emerging out of poverty, so middle-income countries, and places that are very, very warm. So India is going to be perhaps the next one. India right now has very little air conditioning, and most households in India are too poor to afford air conditioning. But that's changing. Incomes are rising around the world, and as people come out of poverty, they want to buy stuff, and one of the things they buy is air conditioning.
So there's a good news story there. Incomes increasing. People in hot places can have some of the same benefits we do here in the United States. But you write in this paper that comes with potential costs. Can you talk about, first of all, how much energy we're using in our air conditioning?
It's an enormous amount of electricity. A typical room air conditioner uses 10 to 20 times as much electricity as a fan. So as people buy air conditioning, their household electricity consumption can easily double. In terms of the fraction of air conditioning, in a high income country like the U.S. with a medium climate, 10, 15, 20% of total electricity can go towards air conditioning demand. It's smaller than that elsewhere in the world, but it's still the potential for this to just increase electricity demand around the world is staggering. And it is a real challenge. It's a challenge for countries to meet that increase in electricity demand.
Right. So if you're in one of those countries that's been lower income in the past, now you have all these air conditioners, all this rising demand, what kind of things are you looking to see to meet that big boom in electricity demand?
I'll tell you, right, south of the border is a great example. So Mexico is absolutely seeing this right now. So northern Mexico, we've gone from very low saturation of air conditioning to now the northeastern states, so Tamaulipas and Nuevo León, Mexico, now have 70% plus of households have air conditioning. It's really happened overnight. So it's households, so people are just going to stores and buying air conditioners, bringing them home and installing them. And so what the National Electricity Utility in Mexico has had to do is all of the above. They've had to invest massively in new generation sources. They've had to invest in transmission lines, invest in distribution lines. They're basically working as fast as you possibly can to increase infrastructure to meet this increasing demand.
Talking to Lucas Davis, he's an associate professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He focuses on energy and economic analysis. Lucas, as the air conditioning demand increases, we're using more and more of it. The obvious concern, I guess, is we're wanting AC more because the world is getting warmer, but that energy increase you're talking about is going to increase carbon emissions, leading to more global warming. Are we headed into an ugly cycle here?
Yeah, I mean, it is ironic that as the temperatures increase, what we're doing to adapt to that, what we're doing to stay cool, is actually creating more carbon dioxide emissions, thereby creating more warming. It is ironic. I think moving forward, the big question is, well, where is electricity going to come from? Today, around the world, most electricity comes from fossil fuels, but there's great optimism that could change. It's not going to change overnight, but over the next several decades, we could move to having much lower carbon-based electricity.
Is air conditioning more efficient now than it used to be? Is it less of a hit per unit of air conditioning than it once was?
That's a great point. It is. So air conditioning is about twice as energy efficient as it was in the 1970s. So engineers have worked very hard to try to squeeze out as much cooling as you can possibly get per kilowatt hour of electricity. I'm worried that is... Although I hope we keep working on it, I'm worried that there's going to be limits to how much of that we can do. I think where there's maybe more scope for technology to increase kind of a broader sense of efficiency is more on design of buildings. Can we design buildings to keep them cooler? Can we use natural shade? Can we insulate our homes better? Can we design better windows? Can we deliver? You know what the exciting thing here is that people are more comfortable in their homes. They're not sweating. They're happy. Can we deliver that same thermal comfort, but with less electricity consumption?
But that sounds like a really slow answer. We're not going to suddenly redesign every home, office, store, other building on Earth.
Absolutely, that's something. So I'm at UC Berkeley in California, and that's something that California has set some of the most ambitious electricity energy efficiency goals in the country. But that's something that we've an absolute challenge here is when so much energy use comes from existing buildings, what do you do? What do you do? And you're exactly right. It is very hard and often prohibitively expensive to retrofit existing buildings.
Let's look at a potential scenario. We'll call it a worst-case scenario. We keep expanding the use of air conditioning. More and more hot countries that are currently too poor to afford air conditioning, well, now they can afford it, and they get it. We see the use of air conditioning multiplying, and we're charging that with fossil fuels. We're not doing it with renewable energy. What is your worry if we continue on that path?
Yeah, so that corresponds closely to kind of the most aggressive emissions scenarios considered by, for example, the IPCC. And that kind of outcome, based on the consensus in the scientific literature, leads us to a 6, 7, 8 degrees of average temperature warming by end of century. So that could lead to, that's really catastrophic climate change.
Supposing we in the United States wanted to provide leadership on this, is it an awkward conversation if we're saying to these countries now developing, getting more and more air conditioning, oh, ease off, guys, or make sure you use renewable fuels, when we've been not practicing that for some decades now?
Yeah, I think, absolutely. I mean, and it goes back to fundamentally, this is a good thing. People being cool in their homes is good. And, no one should tell a household that they cannot buy this thing that's going to make them very happy. I think in terms of policy leadership, it's more about setting prices right. So that means adopting a carbon tax, which I'm very optimistic the U.S. Will do sooner rather than later. And then leading on R&D, so investing in technology, trying to design better air conditioners, trying to design better ways of keeping cool and or creating electricity without creating as much carbon dioxide.
And one of the main points in that paper that led us to give you a call was the idea of a carbon tax. That's a phrase that's thrown around a lot. Can you talk about what that might look like if it were passed here in the United States?
Yeah. So first, I'd say economists love the idea of a carbon tax. Why do they love it? By setting a carbon tax, what that would do is it would set the incentives right for all kinds of better behavior. So what would you see in practice? We'd see gas prices would go up, electricity prices would go up, natural gas prices would go up. Everything that you do would now be reflected with a new set of higher prices, reflecting the fact that the consumption of electricity creates negative externalities. So it creates carbon dioxide emissions and other negative effects on other people. Now you say, well, wait a second, this just sounds like I'm going to pay more. Well, the great thing about a carbon tax is that it generates a lot of revenue. That revenue doesn't disappear. This revenue goes to the government, and the government can choose to reduce other taxes. So we could actually reduce everybody a whole bunch of other taxes that economists actually don't like as much as a carbon tax, replace it with a carbon tax, lead everyone to make better, cleaner, greener choices, and reduce distortion somewhere else in the economy.
We're talking with Lucas Davis, Associate Professor of Economic Analysis and Policy at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, taking a look at the global impact of the rising use of air conditioning and the challenges that creates.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the world is ready to handle an increased demand for air conditioning? And what do you think this will mean for global carbon dioxide emissions? And what, if anything, can or should be done to meet that demand? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking about the global impact of air conditioning as income levels and temperatures rise and what it might mean for the planet. Our guest is Lucas Davis, Associate Professor of Economic Analysis and Policy at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the rising use of air conditioning around the world? Do you use it? Do you feel bad when you use it? Are you glad you have it? What do you think about the potential environmental impacts? And what do you think about the idea of a carbon tax? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Chad is online in Monaco. That's Monaco, Wisconsin. Yeah, Chad, hi.
Yeah, I just think the people that push the idea of a carbon tax, it's not fair to people that have to drive for a living or people that are in parts of the country where that need more heating and cooling. These people that just constantly want to steal money are just ruining the country and making it impossible.
Chad, thanks for the call. Lucas, the idea that some people would be unfairly hit by carbon taxes.
Yeah, I'm extremely sensitive to that concern, and I've done research on how carbon tax and gasoline taxes would impact, in particular, low income households. And I think what's missing from that discussion is that a carbon tax or a gas tax creates revenue that can then be used to do things. And I think one great way, if what you're concerned about is impact for low income households, a great thing to do is to increase use of the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit. So you could take revenue generated from a carbon tax, and you could double the Earned Income Tax Credit. And so give low-income households and working households in the U.S. a much larger tax rebate that they can then use to pay for that gas tax, making them not worse off.
Chad, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Joseph in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Joseph, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I think a lot of it's true, but on the housing, I was a carpenter for like 25 years, and a lot of these houses and buildings, I think myself, have too many windows in them, and they could also be better insulated to where the air conditioner would run less to let the heat escape in and the cool air escape out. That would be one thing they could do when they build new houses, but...
Joseph, thanks a lot for that call. And that gets to that building design idea you were talking about, Lucas, that with some forethought or maybe some retrofitting, we could lower our need for air conditioning and heating, too, for that matter, I guess.
Yeah, I know one thing. Another thing people have found is that many air conditioners are poorly sized for the units, sometimes, and oftentimes twice as large of an air conditioner as you need, so you can save a lot of energy just by getting the right sized unit. Get energy prices right, and that would incentivize people to make better choices along all these dimensions.
Joseph, thanks for the call. Chuck is with us next in Woodstock, Illinois. Chuck, hi.
Hi, how are you? How are you today?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I completely agree with what you're saying about air conditioning. The carbon tax is a great idea, but I think offsetting with lowering other taxes would be a huge battle. And then the other comment I wanted to add to it is that, well, he's talking about the developing nations as being a big source of the demand for energy and air conditioning. He didn't mention, but I'm sure he's thought of, that the population growth compounds that. With huge population growth and a shift to middle-class incomes and the demand for all energy-producing items, it's going to really contribute to global warming.
Chuck, thanks a lot for that call. Let's take each of those points in turn. First of all, Lucas, a lot of people probably share Chuck's skepticism. If the government generates new revenue, in this case in the form of carbon tax, do we really think they'll ultimately use it to lower their revenue in another realm?
You know, I think when you could see a carbon tax put in place, perhaps politically the best chance to do it would be when the government is exactly facing a revenue shortfall. We saw that a little bit in 2008, 2009, when a carbon tax just about made it through Congress, and I think you could see it again. In that case, you would just be offsetting, you wouldn't be imposing new taxes. So, yeah, I think it could be done credibly. In terms of the global impact, I couldn't agree more. This is a staggering challenge. So, not in high-income countries. High-income countries, we're kind of set. But at low- and middle-income countries, energy demand is right now forecast to approximately double over the next two or three decades. That is just an enormous challenge to meet that increase in energy and to do it in a way that doesn't heat up the planet.
Chuck, thanks for the call. We are talking to Lucas Davis from the University of California, Berkeley, looking at the global impact of air conditioning. We use it a lot here in the United States, and a lot of other countries are coming online as they can afford air conditioning. They're generating the power to power that. What's that doing for the environment? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on Facebook as Tim did. Tim writes, I do not have air conditioning and we survive, so I think the electricity usage of AC is a waste. Yeah, it makes me feel better about my impact on the climate, but if anyone offered to pay for it, I wouldn't say no. Tim, thanks a lot for that comment. Lucas, what do you think of this idea of maybe looking at our air conditioning usage as Tim does, a little bit a moral issue? It makes him feel better that he's not using it, but there's a gray area. He might use it if it was free.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that do a lot of things to help the environment on their own accord, but I'm skeptical about that being a solution to a global problem like climate change. I think you have to have policies. I think you have to price carbon dioxide emissions, or you're just not going to get where we have to get.
Thanks, Tim, for that comment. We'll go to Bob on the line in Chippewa Falls. Bob, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was involved in the solar industry back in the 80s, and we sold a solar collector that was capable of air conditioning. American Solar King made an absorption copper plate, and it could be used with an ammonia bromide system to air condition. So it's kind of ideal. The hotter it gets, the more it collects.
Bob, thanks a lot for that call. Lucas, it seems a little paradoxical using the sun to cool down our houses. Is that one avenue of technology that you could see, probably not being the whole solution, Lucas, but being part of the solution?
I can't speak to this exact technology, but it's true that what we've seen over the last couple of years is that the cost of solar PV, solar photovoltaics, has come down dramatically. Actually, just in this last year, the costs have gone down by something like 30% or 40%. It's a remarkable time of progress for grid scale solar plants, and I do think we're going to see a lot more of that.
Bob, thanks for the call. Tom is with us next on the line in Madison. Tom, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I was just wondering if your guest is aware of a group called Citizens Climate Lobby, which is based in California, actually, and I'm a member. I'm in Madison. We've got volunteers all over the country. But what we advocate is a form of carbon tax on the fossil fuel industries. They pay into this pot of money as they extract fossil fuels. And then the money, rather than being used for tax relief, is actually given directly to citizens through checks or direct payments and that sort of thing. So you bypass the whole tax system, you give the money to the people, they can spend it however they want. We've actually done a study that shows that 2/3 of the people in the United States would actually come out of head that way in spite of the rising costs of sort of conventional energy.
Tom, thanks for the call. So Lucas, collect a carbon tax, I guess, in this plan, cut a check or some other means of payment to the American citizenry. What would you think of that approach?
I think the idea of taxing as upstream as possible is a great idea. That makes it easier to do. It's administratively easier to do and cheaper to collect upstream. In terms of giving people lump sum payments, I've seen very similar studies where you can make the bottom two thirds of Americans strictly better off by giving lump sum payments back to them. You can do that, I guess. I view something like the EATC or some kind of more explicitly redistributive use of the taxes as a better approach if your goal really is to address inequality. But I definitely see the appeal of the simplicity of that plan, and I see the appeal of that.
Lucas, as we wrap up, do you think that there's a political opening to do something like this carbon tax?
Yeah, you know, believe it or not, I do think the first 100 days of the next president, I think, is an opportunity to do something. I feel more optimistic about this than I have in quite a long time.
We'll leave it there. Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Lucas Davis. He's an associate professor of economic analysis and policy at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, where he's the faculty director of the Energy Institute. He joins us to talk about the global impact of increased air conditioner usage. He authored a recent paper on that topic, talked about the impact of the growing use of air conditioning around the world, the impact it could have on climate, and called for this idea that we ended with there, a carbon tax, a tax on fossil fuel use at some level or another. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this topic. Continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you use air conditioning? How much do you use it? Do you wish you had it if you don't? Could you do without it if you do? And what do you think about this idea, this approach, a carbon tax? Share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Today in 1969, the legendary Woodstock Music Festival kicked off in New York State with a ton of legendary bands. And according to legend, a lot of people who were there don't remember much. A lot of people who weren't there claim to have been there.
And closer to home this weekend was the second annual Eau Claire Music Festival, celebrating the hot Eau Claire music scene and bringing in bands from around the country.
If you missed the big show, the Eau Claire one that is, not Woodstock, head over to WPR.org/setlist. There you can find a link to WPR coverage of the event, and you can check our interview with the band Tenement from Appleton, one of the artists featured at that festival. So if you could go back in time and go to Woodstock, back because this predates both of us, would you?
That's so easy. I'm too old, right? I think you have to be in your teens or your 20s to fully appreciate Woodstock. If I had access to a time machine, I would not go to Woodstock.
And I probably wouldn't either. A lot of mud, a lot of dirtiness. I don't know. I mean,
or
the music,
sanitation.
I can listen to the music on CD. I can go back and watch the movie. But yeah, maybe I'm a little past my time where I do that sort of thing.
Right.
Anyway, we'll go out with some music from Tenement, not at Woodstock, not Born in Time for Woodstock either, I think. But they did play at the Eau Claire Music Festival this weekend. This is Central Time.